Sunday Night Saffron, a babble about religion, politics, and all things ethnic, with John Saffron and Father Bob Maguire.
G'day, dear listeners. G'day, Father Bob. How are you,
comrade?
Tonight, we have a woman called Cinnamon Whip, and she's the president of the Melbourne Northside Rollers, and she's going to be talking to us about roller derby. You like roller derby, don't
I like
you?
Rabble, yeah. I don't need skates.
Feminism and roller derby, it says here. We've got a very interesting man called Hugo Schweizer. He's an American, and he labels himself a male feminist, and he writes for a lot of online feminist publications. And I think he even writes for Mamma Mia, which is an Australian website.
Exactly.
And he's got a very interesting backstory, a very controversial backstory, because he's a male feminist now, but he was very bad in the past, and he makes things complicated because women say, well, how much bad stuff can you have done in the past and still be able to put yourself up as a spokesman?
So it's going to be an exclusive scoop or what?
No, it's not a scoop at all. It's all on there's lots of feminist websites that are anti-Hugo Schweizer. We'll hear more about him. And he's a Christian, by the way.
Yeah.
You can ask him about that too. It's how much can you forgive someone for their past and let them be a spokesperson for your group?
What kind of a Christian? What are you talking about? Is he American?
We've also got Antti Lowenstein. He's going to either talk about Haiti or Israel, depending on what depending what mood I'm in. He's a writer, of course. He's on here all the time.
Yeah.
And we're also going to be speaking to Steve Brax, former premier of Victoria. I spoke to his frenemy just last night, Steve Brax, former premier of Victoria for the Labor Party. I went to the premier's literature awards because two of my friends were up for prizes.
The biggest estate in the world.
The Victorian Literature Blah. Yeah. Alice Pung was up for non-fiction for her book My Father's Daughter or something.
Yeah.
And my other friend Lally Katz was up for best drama.
She got the medal
for her play Gollum.
Yeah, she got the medal for that.
And oh my God, she thanked me in her speech because I was the one.
John.
I was, dear listener. She got commissioned to do this play on the Jewish mystical creature, the Gollum, and because her surname sounds so Jewish, and she's got like an American accent, but she didn't really know it. She's only half Jewish and didn't really like grow up Jewish or whatever. So she kind of contacted me, didn't know me, and said, I'm in a bit of a bind. I've been commissioned to do this Gollum thing based on my surname and the fact that I talk like the nanny. And they think, seeing I've got the surname Katz and I talk like the nanny, I must be able to write a play on the Gollum. So I lent her all my Gollum books.
And told her the story of the Hungarian Gollum.
Now, wouldn't it be the Czech Gollum, I think.
Czech Gollum? Are you sure? I thought it was
in Prague.
Oh, Prague. Sorry, Prague Gollum. That's right.
Now,
that's
Bob.
Right. That's why I got lost on my overseas trip last week. I couldn't tell the difference between Prague and Hungary.
Now, Bob, I noticed you weren't in the meeting this week.
With whom?
With the boss, Chris Scadden.
Nobody invited me to a meeting this week with the boss.
Well, me and
am I dumped?
No, me and Soypul.
Yeah.
The Turkish producer.
You embarrassed. You didn't ask me.
I didn't. It wasn't for me to ask because they have a meeting with every team.
Yeah. Well, where am I in the team?
To decide what's going to happen next year or whatever. It went okay? It went okay.
Is there an advisory? Like, don't let
there
the
is
old invi- man...
I promise you I'm not making this up, dear listeners. It was decided in the meeting, Bob, that they're going to get you one of those headsets that Madonna wears when she's, like, voguing live in concert. You know the thing with the microphone going up the front?
Yes.
So whether she's voguing to the left or voguing to the right... it's still coming out of her mouth and hitting the microphone. Because there's been a bit of commentary about how you kind of...
Yeah, but who told them they can't see me leaning?
Everyone can hear it. You
dobbed me in. You said scats.
No. I tell you what dobbed you in, Father Bob. The fact that for an entire year, you've been talking like this and then you go like that. And Scat's driving around in his pickup.
Yeah.
Chris Scadden, listening to the show, and he can hear it. No one's dobbing on you.
Dob, 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 dib, dib, dib. Anyway, in behind, starring she's behind next year, me, you're in front of me.
Big changes next year, dear listener.
Scams.
Bob's going to be wearing the Madonna Vogue headset. So his voice remains
you
at a constant.
You mean to tell me this is the only year that I've been floating backwards and forwards to the microphone, as if there's some deterioration?
I'm really getting furious. I'm going to go to a review. Do you know people who even like the show bag you for your your back and forth thing, small and big on the mic? I'll have to get it up later.
Where is it? There. Tell me there. You're making it up. You said it yourself.
No. Let's have a look here. A podcast, Sunday Night Saffron Reviews on iTunes. Let's have a look.
Please.
Customer ratings. Most recent. Let's have a look here. Come on, man. What's happening, man?
You made it up.
They're
making it up, listeners.
I don't know.
They're trying to get a young, fresh-faced Eurasian woman in here as his partner. That's what they're trying to do.
Yes. You're a victim, Bob.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, I can't find it at the moment.
No, because it's not there.
I'm simple.
Mr. Scadden, come and help me. Bumped. All over a false.
We're going to go to a song. I'll come back when I find this assault.
Well,
by
we won't be coming back
punter.
At all because you won't find it. That's why.
Sunday Night Saffron
on Triple J.
I'm Bob McGuire, who apparently has to learn to talk more into the microphone. And that's John Saffron, who can do what he bloody well likes, I suppose. Later on Sunday Night Saffron, we're going to catch up with Hugo Schweitzer to talk feminism.
He's a male feminist.
Sexism and misogyny.
But he's got a real controversial past. You've got to stick around, dear listeners. It's going to be really awkward unless we figure out
how. Can't I finish any of these intros now? And we'll meet the former Premier of Victoria, Steve Brax, to get the lowdown on politicians behind the scenes. Right now, though, we'll find out what all the fuss is about roller derby. Derby. Joining us is the president of the Melbourne Northside All Stand Rollers, Cindy Frost, also known as Cinnamon Whip.
Correct.
Now, roller derby, that's the one where you go around in a circle.
Absolutely.
And what I'm just putting the picture into the... I'm trying to figure out where everyone knows what roller derby is, don't they?
Of course they do.
Yeah, they do until they say to you, so do you have a ball? And
explain what the rules of roller derby are.
The short version of it is that there's a pack with half of your team in it, four players from your team and four players from the opposition, and then you have two jammers, one from your team and one from the opposition. One whistle goes, the pack takes off. Second whistle goes, the jammers or point scorers take off. And long story short, the every time a jammer passes the hips of a person of the opposition, you get a point. So the idea is if you're in the pack, you have to play offense and defense at the same time. So you want to help your jammer through, but you want to stop the jammer of the opposition.
Mm. And if you're not one of the jammers, you're not allowed to just push people over?
You're allowed to push people over in a very technical, legal fashion. So there's a whole lot of rules that go along with contact points and where you're allowed to make contact, what's illegal and what you can be sent off for in a penalty.
Mm. And there's been a revival, but when did it all start?
It was revived in America in 2001 and 2002.
But what was it originally? Somehow in our collective unconsciousness, we've got pictures of Farrah Fawcett Major. Is that her name?
Look, the names are absolutely
Everybody's
brilliant.
Everybody's got tags.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like going around these big-haired people from 1970s going around. Is that when it started or did it start earlier?
It was big in the 70s, but it was bigger in the 30s in America. But the 70s is when it was quite big. When I speak to anyone who is maybe in their 50s and 60s, they remember roller derby being on TV in the 70s in Australia. Mm. And it was, really, really popular then. And there's a whole wave of women who are, in their 60s now who were taking to the track in their 70s, who are fairly extraordinary. I think they were a bit tougher than we are.
Now, there's a documentary coming out at the moment called Roller Derby.
This is Roller Derby.
And did it not start at the very start by this promoter who was trying to figure out a way? There was these existing roller skating rinks and he was trying to figure out a way to kind of provide
Absolutely.
Entertainment.
Yeah.
I love learning about all these sort of promoters and hucksters from the olden days, because you realise before the internet and everyone's just really rich for novelty and entertainment, and you couldn't go off and develop an app. So you'd have to come up with something to try to take the nation by storm from hula hoops to roller derby, and sometimes it would pay off.
Yeah, really, really practical events that these people would create. And in the film This Is Roller Derby, they outlined this promoter that just took the money and ran after it. It wasn't really with a vision to continue with creating a sport or a spectacle or an event, but the women that were involved in it just went, hang on a minute, this guy's gone, but, you know, this is kind of cool, so let's see what we can do from here.
Mm. And when did it take off in Australia?
Around about 2007-ish. Okay. And there are a lot of women who have come from more established leagues in other countries, so particularly from London or from America, who have come to Australia, who already had experience in other places. And they might be Australian women who have just been away working overseas and come back again. So there's lots of knowledge that has and connections from American
skaters. And the big place in America is at Austin, Texas.
Absolutely.
It's good in the doc how you see that. Have you seen that film? There's this new film out called Bernie's.
Not yet.
And it's got a map of Texas and explains how Texas is so divided. That's why it's so hard to describe, because you've got like, you've got the deep south in Texas, in inverted commas, plus you've got like the most hipsterville in Texas, you know, in places like Austin, and they're all different, which is why everyone gets their head scratching trying to figure out whether it's a bunch of backwards yokels there or a bunch of, you know, inner city hipsters there.
Yeah.
Is it a swinging state?
I'm not sure.
Who they vote for? That's the big thing.
Well, what's his face? He was there. He's big there. Who? You know, the Rick Perry. Rick Perry, the one.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But listen, how many, what do you call them, were the places where you play the game?
What, the rinks?
Yeah, the rinks. Are they all over the place, or do you got to go to special rinks?
Well, we actually train at it's not a commercial rink as such. It's just a track. There's a lot of roller hockey played there and a few other sports.
Oh. So it can accommodate all kinds of similar sports.
We also train on a basketball court at a YMCA.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there's lots of places around now, roller skating rinks that have got tracks down, that have got the standard measurements of the track so that, you know, leagues can train there and hire that place as a venue.
Mm.
And they're real women heavy.
Absolutely.
And like you really get the impression it's like this organic thing and women run it and they love it.
It's true. And it's kind of interesting. Derby pulls a whole lot of women from a whole lot of areas. So you've got, there's a large percentage, and statistically, I'd love to make it up, you know, maybe 80 or 90% of women.
Yeah. I'm happy with making up. That's the whole show. We make everything up here.
Women that have not had much contact with team sports before, which is fairly interesting to be drawn to a team sport. And, you know, there's a couple of women in our league that have been highly competitive on other areas of sport, but have either retired from those sports, become a little bit bored of them, or have had babies and then come back to, you know, fitness and sports. It's very diverse women that are drawn to roller.
And somehow seems to be tapping into some sort of zeitgeist of the inner city, of where you take slightly ridiculous things from other cultures and you're having fun and really loving it, but sort of winking at the camera and realising you're being a bit silly as well.
Well, roller derby is actually a ridiculous sport, in my opinion. I mean, who really wants to, for starters, we make pretty heavy contact sometimes, you know, so it's a full contact sport for women. There's not many of those that are around, really. Mm. And it's on wheels, which is weird. That's an extra dangerous component there. It's so very funny, though. I mean, we had a training session last night. I was training some of the girls in the junior levels within our league, and everyone was falling over all the time, which is what you're supposed to do. Mm. You're pushing your limits. You're learning about new things. And the laughter on the track was phenomenal. Everyone was just finding what we're doing
feel
ridiculous.
Better. Therapeutic.
I heard that it might have been in Melbourne, that a transsexual wanted to join and that it was, like, controversial.
Well, that's one of the things that I find awesome about roller derby is that we have some transgender women around skating in our league and in other leagues around Victoria. And it seems to be one of those sports where there can be controversy around it, I suppose, but there's also so much sexual diversity within a roller derby league. You will have gay, bisexual, transgender, straight. You've got women with families, you know, lots of kids. And it's really diverse, and it's a bit of a shoulder shrug to me. It These things don't really matter that much. But there are policies at higher levels that help to, you know, define how to approach these things if they are complicated within your league. So there, and through WOFTA, which is the acronym of the Women's Flat Track Roller Derby Association.
Oh, it's nice, isn't it? WOFTA.
Yeah. And that comes from America. There's a whole, you know, set of rules, policies, guidelines, you know, to help structure things that might be otherwise complicated to develop yourself when you're making it up as you go.
And we've got special advisors for the partners of the women roller derby person.
As in they become derby widows.
Yes.
Well, one of the girls in our league said to me a long time ago, she said, oh, you know, I only have to really make this 60% of my attendance. So, you know, if I miss one session a week, I'll probably be okay. And I spoke to her again about 3 months later about whatever we were talking about. She said, I can't miss a session. I'm so addicted to this. And so there you do end up with derby widows, and her husband is, you know, really supportive of roller derby because it does really good things for women, you know.
Now, is it right that rockabilly is part of the aesthetic? And
yes.
If so, why? Is that also just because it's from the
it's kind of like
South?
It's kind of like a little subculture in there. There's rockabilly music or rockabilly-looking girls. There's also lots of tattoos and lots of piercings. And at the same time, there's lots of really straight, conservative, regular-looking folk that you can't tell that they play roller derby. And there's lots of different coloured hair. And it's just so... just. Everyone's different from each other, but it's this hub of energy of women getting together.
And they're dressing up and, you know.
There is a bit of dressing up. There's always going to be the argument of sport over spectacle in roller derby. So some women come into it and go, this is a spectacle. I'm getting fresh meat. They come in and they've got frilly skirts and makeup and fancy, you know, gimmicky type things. And then by the time they're at a bouting level, they're like, okay, that skirt's really annoying. I need these shorts. This is just going to work better than that.
Yeah.
And that strips
who
away.
Who turns up to watch it? Men or women?
Everyone, families, you know. The audience is really broad. Like we have grandparents coming along to watch their grandkids play. We got parents, you know, lots of families.
Yes.
People dress up, you know. It's fantastic.
Mm.
Well,
I presume the Taliban wouldn't approve.
What?
I can't imagine that they would.
Would you?
I'd be interested in see a league start up in.
Isn't it in Afghanistan?
Really weird, out of nowhere kind of.
Well, that's
vaguely...
what I'm here for. That's what they hire me for.
Awkward.
You know
comment.
What I mean? Distant comments, and then the incisive one.
Now, if people want to know more about roller derby, they can watch This Is Roller Derby. Go to thisisrollerderby.com. Or what else? Where can I just turn up somewhere? Or it's in Adelaide, isn't it?
That's where the Great Southern Slam happens every second year. We were there this year, a fantastic event. There's roller derby in Melbourne and Ballarat and Bendigo and Rosebud and all sorts of places all the time.
What about is there one in Brisbane, I heard?
Oh, absolutely. There's roller derby in every city in Australia and lots of regional areas as well. So it's one of the fastest growing women's sports around. The next bout that we have is on the 27th of October, and that will be in Rosebud.
Bowl?
Actually at Bruno's gym. It's like on a court.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And good luck and, you know, stay safe enough.
Don't break.
Not too safe.
Safe enough.
Yeah.
Safe enough
don't
is good enough.
Don't break a leg.
Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
Still to come, we'll meet former Victorian Premier Steve Braxton. Shortly we'll catch up with Anthony Lowenstein, co-editor of After Zionism.
And also the male feminist with a controversial past, Hugo, let's just call him Hugo.
That's right, Hugo.
Bob, can I just read out this review from iTunes?
Oh, go on, you just made it up. You just
interesting,
put it on the
interesting
phone.
And a laugh by Stephen Ch88. Just love it. My only petty complaint is the sound levels. Bob seems to lean in and out a lot of the mic, loud to quiet to a frustrating and uncomfortable level. A slight adjusting of sound before release might be easier than teaching Father Bob about speaking into the mic.
Why would it be easier?
That's minor, though, really, because I do love the show, oh so dearly. Cheers. Thank you very much, Steve.
Oh, isn't that nice? So that's one of your fans.
The
What about the brilliance and the insightfulness of my comments?
Do you know there's a trampoline scene?
What do you mean a trampoline scene?
There's a trampoline scene.
Oh, is there?
My friend rang me up and said, hey, me and my sister, some of my sister's friends, we're going to go to the trampolines. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. So anyway, so I got in the car with them and we drove down to like this industrial wasteland.
What, over in Footscray or somewhere?
No, no, no. Just in this industrial area.
Yes. No names.
Okay, no names. And you walk in there, it's like a hollowed out building, but inside there's just like heaps of trampolines built
walls
into the ground.
All trampolines.
And it's all like colourful everywhere, right? And it's this real scene, like everyone there looks like they're in Glee or in Step Up.
Yeah.
And like it's really like lived in. Like it's like, oh, it's where they come after school to kind of hang out. And then everyone just jumps up and down on these trampolines. I reckon if I was a Hollywood producer, I would definitely be going, oh, this will be the next, I'm going to do a film like this, you know, a la Step Up or whatever.
After Gangnam.
Yeah, where there's two gangs down at the trampoline place and they have a trampoline off. And I did wonder whether, I started wondering, like, why is this, like, happening, like, now?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, is there a thing now compared with, like, decades ago where parents aren't comfortable with other kids coming over to their houses and jumping on the trampolining because,
health and safety.
You know, I don't want to be responsible.
Broken arms.
Yeah, I don't want to get sued or whatever. Yeah. Whilst, you know, back in the olden days, like, kids would just go over to everyone else's house and light fires.
Yeah, I broke my arm at John Safran's place. It's a talking point.
The other interesting thing I saw about is it's really...
Were you trampolining?
I was trampolining.
Get away at the age of 40, for God's sake. Truly.
It was fun.
You didn't lose your lunch?
No.
So to speak?
The other thing that was interesting was that it wasn't very controlled. Like you'd think that a business like that, there'd be like policemen everywhere making sure no one jumps until someone else jumps and all that stuff. Because there's big pits where you can jump into the foam and then everyone... But you just have to sort of like keep your eyes open and sort it out for yourself. And then I thought the logic of that is that... Have you heard that thing about towns where they take down all the street signs? Because they say that as soon as people know there's not street signs, they start concentrating a lot more.
Oh.
I don't know if that's an urban myth or whatever. Yeah. But that's how this place operated was... Like, you just knew, unless you kept your eyes open,
you
that plumbed. You were going to get killed or kill someone else.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? So you were looking for directions. It's sad, isn't it? We all need directions as to who can jump next. Poor devils that we are. That's marvellous. Well, see, you've had a new experience. So I haven't had many of those.
No.
See? You know, except, testing life support systems or something. Which one gives the biggest burst of oxygen?
Now, coming up next, waiting for us in the Sydney TARDIS, is Anthony Lowenstein, who's either going to be talking to us about Haiti, which he went to, or Israel, which he went to. Depending on what mood I'm in.
Yeah,
and
well,
it's
I'm
what
not
mood
talking.
I'm in, not what mood he's in.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
You're listening to Triple J. Still to come tonight, we'll talk sexism, feminism and misogyny with Hugo Schweitzer. Right now, though, sitting in a little booth in Sydney, is co-editor of the book After Zionism, Anthony Lowenstein.
Hi, Anthony Lowenstein. How are you?
I'm good, John.
He's mocked me all night, so I suppose. Can you make up for it or something?
I'll try.
You went to Haiti, didn't you?
I did. I was there recently, yes. Like you, many years ago.
Yeah, at least when I did, I had the decency just to prank everyone. No, I didn't even prank. I did a voodoo ceremony. I explored voodooism.
I remember. Wasn't that about 1985 when you were there?
Yes, something like that. Why did you go?
I was there. I'm working on a book and a documentary about disaster capitalism. So I actually wanted to go and see some voodoo, but didn't have time, sadly. But looking really at the way in which countries like that, or a few months ago I was in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Papua New Guinea and parts of Australia in the West, are privatized and outsourced for the benefit of corporations, governments, etc. So
like when a disaster hits in Haiti, like it did with whatever.
I mean, obviously there was an earthquake in January 2010. The country was already on its knees before that, economically and politically. But the earthquake strikes, the country is convulsed. There's about 250,000 people killed. And what you find since then, although it was happening before, but it was accelerated since 2010, is the use by USAID, which is the American aid part like AusAid here, who are supporting and encouraging certain corporations, particularly American and others, to exploit, basically to use cheap labor for various ends in Haiti. And you have a government which is very undemocratic. You have a situation...
But how come that's not a good thing, that they're trying to build businesses there?
Building businesses is great, but the problem with most of the investment that's happening is a lot of it does not particularly go to individuals as anything sustainable. If you pay someone, for example, as I saw in sweatshops, $5 a day US, when the average wage is $6 and two of those $5 goes towards transport and food, you're basically paying them slave wages. And the idea that you give someone a job does not in itself mean that they are sustainable. It doesn't mean that it's healthy. It doesn't mean that it actually provides any kind of independence for the country. The country is deliberately kept on its knees to benefit a variety of corporations.
Really? Deliberate? I like, I understand like laws of unintended consequences.
But the Yanks have done it all.
Why does America have a motive to keep people poverty-stricken as opposed to unintended consequences?
It always has.
I'm not saying, when I say that, I'm not saying every single person in the US State Department who makes these policies, you know, are evil incarnate. I don't mean that for a second. What I mean, though, is that a lot of the corporations that the US government is supporting are encouraged to provide policies that don't actually give sustainability to Haitians. If you basically engage in certain policies that deliberately keep the country economically on its knees, you aren't helping. Of course, there are many people in the NGO sector, some of whom I spend time with, who are trying to do good work there. But the issue is two things. One, a country like that, which is already poverty-stricken, it's a reliable market next to America. Obviously, it's in America's backyard. Haiti has been, for at least half a century, if not more, in fact, more than that, really, supporting dictatorships that the US has armed, backed and supported. And you have Haiti in some ways not unique in that way. You have a lot of poor countries that are kept in that way to be a reliable market, both for products, crap products that are coming from China and elsewhere, but also to make the kind of stuff that you and I buy in our shops. Like
really?
Gap,
what's being mass-produced in Haiti that's been...
Well, Gap is one example. There's Gap factories that are down there. And what
do you think the Gap people are thinking? Are they thinking... Nothing? Are they thinking we're helping out? Did Wycliffe Jean or whatever from the Fugees come to them and go, oh, listen, you're actually going to do my country a big favour if you help build businesses there? And they said, oh, this is great. We need stuff done and we're helping a country build up.
It's hard to know what's in Wycliffe Jean's mind, really. But there was a big New York Times article about that very man last week. He started an NGO which was expanded after the earthquake and was found to be unbelievably corrupt and useless. So the idea that Wycliffe Jean, who, as you say, is Haitian, has really been a disaster. And that, I think, is symptomatic of the issue here, where you have a lot of NGOs. There are thousands upon thousands of NGOs. It's almost like an NGOization of a conflict and or a situation. It's not a war zone per se, but there's instability. And you find in a place like Haiti, like I saw in many other countries, a great number of NGOs who deliberately exaggerate
What about the government of Haiti? Is one way of looking at these places that businesses from the Gap to whoever else would be happy with a number of options and just and because the governments are so corrupt and so bad that's the way they go.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think you asked me a minute ago about how do I think Gap as a company sees Haiti. I mean, I obviously don't want to speak for Gap as an organization, but you see this time and time and time again where countless clothing corporations, electronic corporations, I mean, look at the ongoing controversies with Foxconn in China where Apple makes many of its products. There are countless examples where workers are mistreated, excessive suicides, etc. These issues are happening all over the world. Haiti is just one other example. The difference is that the rhetoric that you hear from many NGOs, elements of the US government and many multinationals is that they're helping Haiti by these policies, when in fact there's countless evidence from economists and from many others and some NGOs that are saying that these policies are they are definitely creating an environment where vulture capitalism works. I mean, it's not just a conspiracy. The evidence is overwhelming that the country is kept in that way for a reason. I think there are some, John, I'm sure, people in the Gap who would be upset to know that they are paying slave wages to employees. I'm presuming that would be the case.
If you were to give a percentage, you know, on the back of an envelope, how much responsibility do you think governments that run these places are responsible, whether it's in Haiti or whether it's in Africa? And I ask that because maybe sometimes, I mean, not you, but sometimes people are like kicking away at the wrong thing. Like maybe people should be kicking away at the dictators in Africa.
Absolutely.
In Africa, for instance, because the businesses probably, if the dictators started wanting to help their own people, then suddenly all these companies would have to work around that instead.
There's definitely responsibility of the Haitian government. I was looking into that when I was there. I mean, the Haitian government in the last years, more than for many decades, has at least a veneer of democracy. There was an election. There were questions about the validity of that. But nonetheless, there is a degree of respectability, which was not the case for decades when you have dictators who are killing their own citizens. That's happening far, far, far less these days. There's responsibility for that. But in the relationship, the key relationship that Haiti has is with the US. And that relationship, I mean, you can almost say by definition, is always going to be master and servant by the very nature of their respective economies. But ultimately, America, as I said, speaks the language of assisting its neighbour, which only takes 3.5 hours, as you know, to get there from New York, which is where I flew from. But there, I think, is a sense that the Haitian government, the sort of people that are put into those positions or allowed to run, or that are president, prime minister, the two key individuals in Haiti at the moment.
Who was that? Who was that Catholic guy that... Papa Doc. I'd love to...
Papa Doc. Well, it's funny. Papa Doc actually is now back in the country. For listeners who don't know, he was a dictator who ran the country for many, many years. He was in exile in France for 20
years. Are you sure it's Papa Doc and not Baby Doc?
Sorry, my mistake. You're right. It's Baby Doc who's back in the country. Indeed. Baby Doc. Baby Doc is back in the country.
The son of Papa Doc.
Indeed, the son of, who's accused of heinous crimes against humanity and is essentially living in luxury. I drove past his house, his mansion, a number of times in Port-au-Prince, the capital. He's living there without any concern about being arrested or charged in an international court.
Because
America doesn't want to arrest him for obvious pretty good reason.
And one of the interesting things about Papa Doc and Baby Doc is they really tapped into the voodoo spiritual beliefs of the country. And so people thought he was the human form of a particular voodoo god. And that's how he managed to kind of scare people and keep control, because people actually believed he was able to, like, go around and, like, kill you using his magic voodoo.
And usually he just was using death squads instead. But look, whatever, who's comparing
now,
it to?
Now, who was that guy that was meant to help everything out, that Catholic guy? Was he even a priest or whatever?
And he was going to become
Duvalier
or somebody.
He was going to become president or prime minister or whatever, and everything was going to be good. Whatever happened to him?
You mean Aristide?
Yeah, yes, that's that
Aristide.
Guy.
Yeah, well, Aristide. He was leader of the country twice. He was overthrown twice.
What do you think of him? What do you think of him?
I think his record is mixed. There's no doubt that he was dealing with profound inequalities when he came into power. He was attempting initially, I'm told. I met some of his, not him personally, but some of his former ministers. He was certainly left-wing. He was progressive. He was pissing off the US government like, I guess, Chavez does now.
Liberation theology man, maybe.
Yeah, and as time went on, there's no doubt there were more authoritarian elements that were put in place, which clearly is a problem. But he was trying to address, and from my understanding, with a degree of success, but also some failures too, to address what is profound inequality. I mean, the inequality you see in Haiti is so out of control. I mean, you're driving down the middle of Port-au-Prince, which is where the earthquake hit the worst in 2.5 years ago, and you see a situation where buildings are still collapsed. You see cholera-infected water running through the streets. It's a profoundly disturbing situation,
Now,
despite
what...
the fact that there are billions of dollars that have supposedly gone to help the country. Mm. And also, Haiti has dealt with decades of repression. I mean, it beats people down for a hell of a long time when the average wage and the unemployment level is so low. And there's no doubt that people like Sean Penn, who listeners might know has an NGO, it was formed after the earthquake in 2010. He spends a lot of time down there talking about how he's helping the country. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests that, in fact, people like that, and this is a personal view, are more part of the problem rather than the solution, because they're actually not really mostly hiring any locals and therefore not empowering people to be sustainable. So you can have lots of foreign aid workers coming in, and some of them are doing good work, but if you don't support local individuals, it's not sustainable at all.
Do you think there's something fatalistic about the Haitian belief system, a voodoo, that actually is not helping?
Yeah, look, I spoke to a lot of people there who said that we should explain that it's not the voodoo, although I didn't see a ceremony per se, and I know you did, John, years ago, but it's not traditional voodoo that people might imagine, which is people's, you know, sacrificing babies or animals. That's different sorts of voodoo. Some of it is a animalistic. It's a variety of different religious beliefs, which has some of them at least elements of Christianity in there as well for some people.
But people say that because of that belief system, which is quite fatalistic, which is you don't really have free agency to affect your own life because anyone can come over at any time and cast something on you, that feeds into this whole thing that's not helpful with rebuilding a country. Like, for instance, people would have interpreted that earthquake in a very spiritual form. They would have interpreted it as either we've done something wrong or someone's done something wrong. And one of the things, I remember there was this evangelical Christian minister around the time of the earthquake in the United States, and he was saying, oh, this is because, you know, 200 years ago, the founder of Haiti, he did a pact with the devil and he sacrificed this pig on a mountain or something like that. And everyone, like, went crazy and was like, oh, my God, who's this idiot, blah, 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 blah. But a lot of local Haitians, whilst they might have disagreed with the detail of what he said, I thought the irony is a lot of them would have kind of agreed with the sentiment. They would have actually thought the reason this has happened to us is because of some, like, supernatural thing, is because we've been cursed for something that we've done.
Mm. Look, certainly my experience was not that. I can't say that there are no Haitians who think that. There are obviously some Haitians who have those beliefs, that's true, but I didn't really meet many of them. I mean, I think most people thought that the earthquake was, you know, a tragedy that came out of control or, you know, out of nowhere. But the issue, I think, for most people I spoke to, and I guess this is what I was looking at for disaster capitalism, was how these issues are dealt with once they happen. I mean, obviously the beliefs of the people are key, but Haiti is not really an independent country. I mean, it's owned by a variety of outside forces. So when you go to a place like that, and as soon as you land, you find a nation which is the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. So, yes, there's voodoo and there's superstition, which is really central to that country. But at the same time, it ain't doing a hell of a lot, I think, to, in my view, in my experience there, to inhibit the country moving forward. There are major forces that are far bigger than that which are doing that for them.
Now, Anthony, your new book, your next book will talk more about that. This book is called After Zionism, One State for Israel and Palestine.
Yes.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran with John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Later on Sunday Night Safran, we're going to talk to Jezebel writer Hugo Schweizer about the hot topic of the moment, that is sexism, feminism and misogyny. So make sure you stick around for that. And shortly we'll meet former Premier of Victoria Steve Brax. Bob Maguire.
Hey,
John Safran.
I'm reading the letters page in the Herald Sun. Can you explain this? Because you know all about history and people. It's about Ando's Ando's Vietnam, which was a very popular, highest rating, 1.6 million show last week on Channel 7, where, you know, very mainstream Vietnamese-Australian comedian goes back to Vietnam and does a bit of a travel log or whatever. But a fellow Australian-Vietnamese guy isn't happy under the heading Arn's Whitewashes. The Vietnamese communist dictatorship must be happy with Ando's show, Arn Does Vietnam. The former refugee happily visited Ho Chi Minh's mausoleum, inserting in his show Hanoi Jane's footage, reminiscing about the anti-war protests that helped the communists win the propaganda war in the West that led to their eventual victory over the liberal democracy of South Vietnam. Ando seems to forget very quickly the reason his family escaped Vietnam and the boat people tragedy where hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese died at sea in their quest for freedom. I don't expect Holocaust survivors to go to Hitler's tomb to pay their respects when they visit Germany and reminisce happily about how 6 million of Jews died in World War II. What is the price of Arn's soul? That's by a Quinn Dow of Baldwin North.
Yes, it's the first of its kind that I've noticed.
Of what the what's
in well, that genre of victims of or their relatives reliving, being reminded of. See, that's 50 years ago. Is it 50 years ago when I was in the army? Because that's when the Vietnam War was on, 40 years ago. But see, I can understand the predicament. You drew the line. There was North Vietnam. There was South Vietnam.
Okay, but in this one, do you reckon Ando, whose side are you on? Ando?
No, but I don't think you have to be on sides. I think you have to be a young person who decides, in fact, to revisit the family's native land. And if he's doing a travelogue, well, then he has to go to North and South. In fact, there's no North and South now. What am I talking about? The whole place is united, so to speak. But the critic in the paper is suffering still and saying, how dare you go to Ho Chi Minh's mausoleum because he's the bloke who caused all the trouble. Whereas you, John Safran, or I, or an objective critic would be saying, don't forget Ho Chi Minh did in fact offer the Americans to help them in their struggle against China, and it was only when that was knocked back and the Americans invaded because the Americans preferred the southern, European...
Look at all the heat that's just scratching beneath the surface of some, like, piece of popular culture.
A lot of heat.
Everyone had 1.6 million people innocently watching that travel show,
yes,
thinking something very uncontroversial was happening.
Yes.
But you're kind of like...
No. Well, I know within the Catholic community even, you see, because I get in trouble, because oftentimes the people who escaped would have been roaming Catholics as well, escaping from the communist regime, which is why the war was waged in the first place. And then yet I'm remembering that, in fact, the corruption of South Vietnam and its Catholic, its European sympathising government was in fact one of the features why there was in such a public support from the North.
I was talking to Nina,
for the overthrow.
I was talking to Nina Las Vegas, who you'd know by listening to Triple J just before, about because she's Armenian, and we're talking about the Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and she watches it a bit more than me, and she was talking about how often in that something bleeds into it. Like, everyone just talks about, oh, it's the dumbest show on TV, which, it, you know, probably is. But there'll be some weirdness, like her boyfriend wants to play basketball in Turkey, and suddenly there's this mainstream reality show with Kim Kardashian, has this half-hour episode explain where she's having a fight with her boyfriend, saying why she doesn't want him to play in Turkey. Weird.
Exactly.
Weird.
Exactly.
Did you hear about this troll that was uncovered this week?
About somebody dying?
No. Oh, no. This is another one. There was this guy who used to upload pretty, nasty pictures.
Yes.
But I'm not sure they were that nasty. He wouldn't take them. Yes. He'd upload photos of women in the street. So they weren't like naked or anything.
No.
But they didn't know their photos were being taken. Anyway, so he'd like upload them onto Reddit. And this other... He got uncovered as to who he was, and this other website, Gawker, said, oh, we've just done our investigation, he's this guy. And then, you know, like that, he's fired from his job, kicked out, and it became like, don't people have a right to anonymity on the web?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, why do people think they do? I mean, you know.
Well, that's the current hot topic, is whether you have the right to be anonymous in this era, when in fact we all know everything about everybody, isn't it?
It's like you might have an expectation, or you might try your darndest not to be found out. That's one thing. But why would you think it's like some right not to, like, isn't it one of those things?
Isn't it one of those things like
you should try to get away with it if you want to get away with it?
Mm.
But then when you're caught, like, who are you complaining to?
Well, you've got the fake John Safran.
Yeah, what?
On Twitter. You could have, I'm not Bob McGuire, by the way. That's my avatar, you see.
Great.
Yeah, but we're getting to the stage.
I'm not going to talk to you
about this. No, I'm not going to talk about it either. But
I've explained myself badly, and you're answering.
I'm helping enormously, yeah.
We're going to be talking to Steve Brax.
Yeah, we better make sense there, hadn't we?
Former Premier of Victoria this.
Sunday Night Safran
on Triple J.
I'm Bob McGuire with John Safran in the chair. You're listening to Sunday Night Safran, and joining us right now is the former Premier of Victoria, Steve Brax.
Who has a book out, A Premier's State. Now, I incidentally spoke to your frenemy last night. I was at the Premier's Literary Awards, and Ted Bailu. And I went up to him. I said I was interviewing you today, and I tried to get goss, but he wouldn't cough anything up. He was very dignified and polite.
Well, yes. Well, it's good to be with you, John and Bob. It's great to be with you. And, well, maybe there wasn't any goss to tell. Always a possibility,
Yeah.
So don't always think on the negative side. It's very possible.
Now, your book, does this go right back to the very beginning of your life? Does it go back to your Maronite grandparents?
Well, actually, my grandparents weren't Maronite. They were Melkite. And the Melkite Church was effectively the Roman Catholic Church in the Middle East at that time. The Maronite had much more a French tradition with it.
Ah.
But the Melkite had was lockstep in with the Roman Catholic Church.
And this is in Lebanon. In Lebanon.
Well, Lebanon, either Maronite, Melkite, Orthodox, there was several strands of Catholicism, if you like, more than Christianity. It is Christianity. So that was my ancestry. But, of course, when they came to Australia, so my grandparents came out with my great-grandparents in the 1890s on both sides. When they came out, there was no equivalent church. There was no Melkite church. And so on my father's side, they became Catholic. And on my mother's side, they became Anglican or Church of England at the time. But when when my mother, Marion, married my dad, yes, post the Second World War, of course she converted to Catholicism and became a much more devout Catholic than any of us. And converts often did that.
That was
de rigueur, of course, to convert was part of the contract.
So they thought they converted
converted
to become Maronites, did they? But they started off as Melkites.
No, they were never Maronites.
They became Roman Catholics.
No, they were Melkites.
They were never Maronites.
Never.
I've made that up. I've been carrying that around with me.
You have, actually.
For like 10 years.
Well, there you go. It's understandable why you had that, because that's commonly the view of the Catholicism in Lebanon. In Lebanon. But no, they were Melkites.
Wow.
They went to the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Church, and both became Catholics. Mm. But of course, in that period, the Orthodox Church and the Maronite Church and the Melkite Church all established. So, but nevertheless, the Catholicism took over, and that was part of what I report on in my book as well.
I was recently talking to your stablemate, Jenny Makakis,
yes,
Member of Parliament, about prisons. And because things are so comfortable in Australia, we often don't think about who's actually operating things. I didn't even know whether is that a federal government thing or a state government thing.
No, it's definitely state.
Yeah, it's a state government thing. And are you happy with the division of powers between the federal government and the state government with all these big things?
I think there needs to be significant cleaning up of the division of powers. Now, there was a bit of that done in the Hawke and Keating period, particularly under Bob Hawke, where, for example, the corporations law, which was ridiculous, it was at a state level. But, of course, a corporation doesn't just operate in Sydney or it doesn't just operate in Melbourne, it operates across the country. So that was ceded to the Commonwealth. Disability laws were divided up between the state and the Commonwealth more effectively, but we still have this mix between health and education between the state and the Commonwealth. And I think it could do with a whole wave of reform to clearly define who is responsible for what in a much simpler way. For example, a good example is education. So if you look at education, primary and secondary education is largely with the states, even though a bit of the funding's federally. TAFE or technical education is 50-50. Mm. Tertiary education is 100% Commonwealth. Now, I would say, let's get rid of that 50-50, have clear delineation. And I would think that would be a much better place for the state, while other things might be better for the Commonwealth. So there's a fair bit of work to be done on that.
There's no way all state parliaments should be wiped out. It'll never happen, so I don't know.
Well, if you're starting again in the Commonwealth of Australia, you might start with a strong national government and strong regional governments, not necessarily based on state boundaries. But, of course, that's not our origination. We started without a national government. It wasn't until 1901 that we had a nation, a Commonwealth of Nations. And it was the state, really what we call colonies there, which were individual countries as colonies of the United Kingdom. And that was our origination. And they ceded power and said, look, let's give power as colonies to the Commonwealth to form a national government. So that's the origination. Now, it's going to be very hard in that context to turn that on its head. Secondly, if you look across Europe now, United States, Europe, UK, of course, you can see devolution is a big thing. You can see in Scotland, they're actually going to be voting the next 2 years on self-government. If you look in Germany or Italy, devolution and giving power down much more locally to regions has been a big thing. So it probably defies gravity to change it significantly.
When you were in power, I guess the internet and all that, and people weren't getting caught out as much on Twitter and text messaging or whatever, did you have the feeling around you that everything I do, every letter I write, I've really got to be careful because this is on the public record or this could get out there and this could... Or did you have more of a feeling of confidence that you could talk on the sly to people and... Because you really feel like now with politicians, they've really got to watch every step.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. One, yes, it's true. I left a bit over 5 years ago and probably the explosion of social media wasn't in place then. email was starting, but not really established as it is now. And I can remember my first experience with email as a premier, because clearly, you know, keeping files in government, recording things, file notes, putting it on file, all that was very important. But, of course, emails became a file. Mm. And I can remember in the early days, people used to email each other, you know, so public servants might email each other. And they email as if they're talking, not as if they're doing a formal letter or a formal response. And sometimes our conversational stuff can be flippant and having a joke which, when you read it, doesn't work that well. And I can remember getting absolutely angry, saying, I'm going to close down the email because of a stupid comment made in an email, which ended up on file, ended up a big public issue. But, of course, I didn't. But number one. Number two, I think if you say one thing to one audience and one thing to another, you'll get found out. That duplicitous nature is usually discovered.
Yeah, but
if you haven't got the confidence to say what you believe in one forum, then you shouldn't be there.
Really? But what so Peter Slipper, in a private matter with someone he knows,
yep,
has to converse with that person in the same way as he would if he was speaking to cameras at a press conference? Like, it seems human nature to kind of like want to sneak off on the sly and have like little sarcastic conversations, yes, and bitch about people. That just seems like totally human, and it seems like...
Well, probably that's an extreme example, because that was a text messaging between, if you like, a boss, yep, and an employee, in that case, a speaker and his staff member, in private, but it wouldn't have become public except for a court proceeding which caused it to be released. And that is an extreme example. But it is telling on what someone thinks or believes in. Yes, that's true. But I was more thinking about, if you like, Mitt Romney's talk in camera to a fundraising group, trying to appease, if you like, the Tea Party and some of the donors, and saying one thing, like 47% of the people are bludgers and on benefits, but not saying it publicly. So he's trying to appease two sides. And I think in that case, that nature of trying to say one thing to one audience to please them and one to another, I think is wrong. And I, rightly or wrongly, I never did that, and I would never do that. I'm not saying I was perfect, of course not, but I think that is something which is a retrograde step in public life, that people believe that they have to talk in code to others. Mm. Ellen Jones is another example, I guess. There has been a couple of those more recently.
He doesn't talk in code enough. He should try keep speaking in code more.
Yeah, now, or maybe speaking less.
I always thought it was weird when the state premier, I think Jeff Kennett was the one, he'd gone 3AW, this local radio show, and people would ring in and say what particular their problem was. Like, he'd be like, well, my train station's got this or that. And he'd like be like the king. He'd suddenly go, well, you leave your number with us and we will figure this out and get it back. And I just thought, that's not what didn't seem like really the way a democracy should run.
Well, not in the sense that you should be available as wide as possible to as many people as possible. So selectively doing it on areas which might be more advantageous to you is probably not the right way to go. Mm. No.
Premier State by Steve Brax, who's not a Maronite, but very disappointed with that. Now I know the details. Yes. And next time I'll be even more, you know.
Forensic?
Yeah, more forensic. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity, Bob. Thanks, John.
Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
On Triple J. Shortly we'll be crossing to America to talk to Hugo Schweizer. We'll find out what he thinks about our PM speech on misogyny. Hmm. Bob McGuire, John Saffron together.
Now,
Sunday Night Saffron.
I'm quite devastated because, do you know the reason I wanted to interview Steve Brax? It goes back 10 years when someone emailed me when I was working at community radio, and they sent me a link to the Vic Rhodes special interest plates, the number plates that you can get, but the special interest ones. And there's one here that's for the Mountain Cattlemen's Association, National Servicemen's Association, Aboriginal Australia number plate, ham radio number plate, harness racing number plate. There's about a dozen of them, right? But the only religious one is the Victorian Maronite community number plate. So this guy who emailed me 10 years ago, he said, don't you think it's a bit suspicious that Steve Brax is a Maronite and the only religious number plate you can get is a Maronite one? So I've been carrying that around with
me for
10 years. And then, of course, because I did my amateur research, which is like, well, you know, he's Lebanese and he's Catholic and they're Maronites. So I've been carrying around for 10 years waiting to, like, Michael Moore jump out at him and accuse him of playing favourites, yes, because the only specialty number plate for a religion is the Maronites. And now I find out he's a Melkite. Great.
I still would Google all that and find out because...
My dad did a...
I thought the Maronites, Saint Maroon, they must be the Orthodox.
The my dad did a dad joke this week.
After you denounced him about the men's gallery.
Well, he came to my flat and he said, he goes, "Oh, do you like Madonna?" And I said, I go, "Oh, yeah, she's okay." Well, I could tell something was coming. And he goes, "Oh, because I heard you like Madonna. So I got you something." And he pulled out of his bag and it was like one of those Catholic candles that you have with Madonna, with the, you know,
the Madonna.
The Madonna, yes, on, yes, the front. And like he picked it up somewhere or whatever. And so now I have a Madonna candle.
So it's
but
a
not
dad
that
joke.
Madonna.
Yes, I see. But I mean,
good one, Dad.
Look, a good one. Yeah, well, I mean, after you denounced him last week as going to the men's gallery,
I did.
Did he take it up with you?
By the way, dear listeners, because I don't want my dad defamed on air, the confusion was...
You defamed him on air.
Yeah, yeah, but there was a context there. Was my dad invited me. He said, "Do you want to go to lunch at the men's gallery?" And I was really confused. But then I found out Man's, M-A-N-S, because men's gallery is a strip joint. But Man's Gallery is this cafe that's attached to
the Toorak Church.
Yeah, to the Toorak Church, named after Mr. M-A-N-S-E.
Poor Alex. Anyway, so, I mean, you know, I was pleased to be in the company of Steve Brax. Pleased.
Do you know who I met this week who's like, what's the word, infamous?
Mm.
I met Bill Henson.
Oh, the painter of the kiddies.
The photographer who got in all that trouble because he takes photographs of people. It was at a Melbourne festival event or whatever.
Yes.
Very smart man. Mm. Very smart. But he told me, we started talking, and he told me about how he just doesn't like stories. Yeah, he says the problem with art, like whether it's books, he was talking about this author he liked. He goes, "The thing I like about it is it's about landscape, you know, this 300-page, it's not about a story." He says he can't stand stories.
Oh.
And I said, "Well, what's art meant to be if not stories?" And he said, "Like objects." He says art should be about objects. What do you reckon?
Well, that's a bit...
It's a bit late for me. I don't think my publisher wants me to deliver a manuscript where it's not about stories but about...
Objects
of Mississippi. Mm. I think, in fact, I get hit in the head if I turn up the
penguin
with that one.
Can I be a bit self-serving?
Yes.
Have you seen my face around the place on lampposts?
No.
On Twitter, they put, "Your face has appeared in Canberra."
Mm.
Some graffiti person...
Mm.
Is putting my face around the traps. Now, is that good or bad? Should one feel
good.
Chuffed or should one feel under threat?
No, I think it's good.
Do you think it's all right?
Yeah, I think it's all right.
I hope they don't put one on church headquarters in Victoria Avenue, because that would be ominous. Mm. Anyway, thanks for that. Who's painting you next?
Oh, actually, someone is painting me.
Yes, I thought so. Go on. Why don't you let it out?
No, because I have discretion.
For the Archibald?
Mm.
Aye? Archibald? Coming out at the same time as the book, followed by the musical.
Shall we go to a news story?
Oh, well, I mean, we're that bored already. I mean, we only have to last for...
What do you reckon?
And you'll
about,
notice
what,
I'm speaking right into the microphone.
What do you reckon about people being chucked in jail for speech? You know, like horrid speech. Are you into that?
No, I don't like throwing people into jail nor executing them.
There was
them.
An article this week in, I think, The Guardian... Telegraph, maybe, in the UK. And it's about how there's really been this trickling of people, like, busted for things that it's really arguably quite strange that they end up in prison for it. For instance, an Azhar Ahmed, a Muslim guy who lives in Yorkshire, wrote on his Facebook page that he hoped soldiers would burn in hell.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the same week that... local regiment had been killed in Afghanistan.
Yes.
And, he didn't get, he was sentenced to 240 hours community service. But that seems like a very grey area. Like, you're against the war.
Yeah, all that.
You think the war's bad.
Yes.
You think soldiers shouldn't, like, at what point does it become...
Yeah, but militarism has become part and parcel. Is it the US of A, I presume?
No, this is in the Yorkshire, in the UK.
In the UK, well, I suppose...
Nice try, dumping it on the feet of
the
Americans.
No, but I'm not dumping, I'm saying, well, it's the same with the United Kingdom. I mean, their soldiers, their warriors are, in fact, their front line.
Sure. But it seems like, do you reckon someone should go to jail for posting on Facebook?
No.
Which he didn't, he got 240 hours community service. Mm. He got off lightly, the article says, compared to Matthew Woods, who made distasteful jokes about a missing girl, or two missing girls, April Jones and Madeleine McCann, I think two.
Well, our Mr. Hicks is going through the same ordeal.
But so he made, well, they don't repeat the jokes, but let's imagine they're the most offensive, awful things about two young girls who've been kidnapped, and I think one killed. So, but this man got 12 weeks jail for, like, distasteful Twitter jokes. Is that what do you reckon? Should he have gone to jail?
Chuck him in jail. Go on.
Okay.
Chuck him in jail. This is like the Roman Colosseum where it's thumbs down.
Barry guy in the UK, he faces a total of 8 months in prison after he was arrested and convicted for wearing a T-shirt that had anti-police statements. I think it was along the lines of, you know, a cop killer type things.
Jail. Pussy Riot.
Jail.
Siberia, in fact, for Pussy Riot. Jail.
Seems like it's pretty easy to get in jail these days in the UK. There was also that woman who was racist on a train.
Half the population in jail when they were coming out on the streets rioting 2 years ago.
There was that racist woman and got caught on YouTube. The thing that's kind of I find really weird about the UK, it seems so media influenced by the media, like a reaction to that. So, for instance, this woman was racist on a train, but the real problem was it was uploaded to YouTube, and then there's this groundswell of social media going, it's outrageous this woman was racist on a train. Like, she wasn't physically threatening. She was sitting there with her child, and she was white, and she was saying to Middle Eastern and brown people around her going, this is my country, this isn't your country. Anyway, there was such an outrage, but she ends up going to jail. And it's like, that gets you in jail? What?
And the new culture worries me now, the walkout business.
The walkout?
Well, they're saying now, well, excuse me to the politician, you were there when that stand-up comedian made the joke. Why didn't you stand up and walk out? Now, that means I'm going to have to stand up and walk out of a corporate breakfast.
Yes.
When, in fact, some bloke is standing up saying the most important thing is to make money.
Yes.
I pop up all of a sudden, walk out, and they say, where's he gone? I'm saying, well, I find that absolutely offensive and obscene. We're all going to be walking out.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? We may as well have a special segment on the show when we say for the next 5 minutes, all will leave the bloody studio as a walkout, but then come back again as soon as we blow the whistle.
We're getting
very, 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 everybody knows everything about everybody now. Well, someone's going to have to teach us how to draw the line.
That's like the thing with the Peter Slip. I don't mind, like, I understand it got, you know, it was put into evidence and he has to give whatever. But it's a whole thing where everyone acts like it's really weird. Like, I cannot believe there was someone who sent text messages bitching about other people they work with. When really, like, I do that to you. Like, as soon as I'm out of here.
Brax was saying a minute ago that happened in the beginning.
On the way back in the train, I'm going to be, you know, texting to my dad about you.
Well, you spoke to Scadden without texting and said McGuire can't talk into the microphone straight. See what I mean? Am I going to walk out?
Really taking this microphone
thing back.
So I am
going to walk out now of the studio because I want to protest.
We're going to be talking to Hugo Schweizer, the male feminist, after this.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
You're listening on Sunday Night Safran Triple J.
Hey,
what?
Can I interrupt you, Bob?
Yeah, what's on now?
Read out a tweet that just came through.
What, they're listening now?
From a Hugo Schweizer. It says, I'm about to be live on some Australian radio program, but A, I don't know which one, and B, I'm blanking on what they want to talk about. But I think he's here, joining us from California. Hugo, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you so much. Yes, the power of Twitter to try and desperately ask for help in a very public way.
Now, Hugo, you've got an incredible story. I guess, like a lot of people, I found out about you because I'd read articles on Jezebel.com for one, and I think you're on an Australian kind of
Mamma Mia,
which is a bit of a female centric, if not feminist, website, and your angles like it seems interesting, where it's like it's a male feminist, and then of course I Google you further, and then you find out you've got this incredible and somewhat controversial backstory, and then it's both fascinating and confusing, and I don't know what to make of it all. Do you want to take us through that?
Well, I mean, it's quite a story to go through. I'm not going to go through every detail, but essentially, the number of men who very publicly identify as male feminists and do feminist work in the States or in Australia is relatively small. Many of the best who are doing this work are in Australia. But, you know, what I think sets me apart, and has set me apart, is that I've been very candid about my past as a drug addict and an alcoholic, and a drug addict and an alcoholic whose behavior at its worst also included a lot of really inappropriate and at times what can only be described as abusive behavior towards women. And so,
and the two things that come up, and you should clarify whether this is right or not. The one thing is you were teaching at a college and you had affairs with women, but that, you know, they were of age, but people still think that's exploitative and not very feminist, I guess. And the other one is a messy story about whether you tried to kill a former girlfriend.
Right. I mean, just really to clarify, I've been teaching at Pasadena City College, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, for 20 years now, both before and after I got sober in 1998. When I was using drugs and alcohol, I did have a series of affairs with female students who were all legal adults and were approximately my age and in one case actually older than I was. But that doesn't change the fact that it was desperately inappropriate and unfeminist. And in my last drug and alcohol binge, fueled by, you know, every imaginable drug, I tried to kill myself and my girlfriend at the time by trying to gas us both to death while she was passed out. It was a psychotic break on my part, but it was nonetheless really, how do you put it? It's sort of the ultimate anti-feminist thing to do. It was a shocking, horrible, terrible thing to try and kill somebody that I loved and try and kill myself.
And why do you, I mean, perhaps it's apparent, but why do you think that there seems to be a lot of women that are really upset that you've now positioned yourself as a sort of, you know, a leader of the male feminist movement, considering your past?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I've positioned myself. I never, you know, it's not as if we go out and get credentials, you know, and say, hello, I'm a leader of the male feminist movement. I've been teaching this stuff for a long time. I've been active where I can be. I try and do a lot of promoting of other people. But I think, you know, the larger question here is what kind of action can be forgiven, assuming that there's been a lot of time lapsed between, you know, the crime or the sin, whatever you want to call it, and the present day, and amends have been made? And what kind sort of earn you a permanent ban? You know, is this... I mean, I think that what makes me want to speak out about this is that though my story is spectacular in terms of its tawdriness, it's not a very, you know, lovely story, it's not that off from the way I know that a great many men have lived. They may not have, you know, tried to kill someone in a drunken binge. They may not have slept with their students, but they have behaved sexually inappropriately at some point. Many men do. They have, you know, fallen short of a mark. And for me, feminism, you know, the political feminism, activist feminism, was not just a tool for making amends. It was a way to show me how to live differently. It gave me the opportunity to live a very responsible life, a completely different life, along with, you know, the, you know, therapy and a 12-step program and so forth. And so I do want to speak out about this because I want other men to understand that we can transform ourselves. We can change ourselves. It's a long process. It's a difficult process. But if we want to build a more just world for our sisters, for our wives, for our daughters, for the women that we love who are just our friends, you know, for ourselves, we need to stop doing what we've been doing. And sometimes the people who are best positioned to make the argument about this are people whose own life story reflects that kind of transformation.
Now, is it difficult for you that a lot of your opposition doesn't come from, for instance, you know, frat boys? Like, there's not like anti-Hugo websites put up there by misogynist pigs, but there's anti-Hugo websites put up there by women who describe themselves as feminists and say, as a feminist, I reckon this guy should be blackballed from the movement. Is that difficult? Because basically the people you want most to empathize with seem to be rejecting you, at least, or some of them.
I mean, it's difficult. In the, you know, the real difficulty is that if there was, you know, if there is no feminist high command based in New York or London or Sydney, you know, there isn't. It's always been a loose movement, and as we know, it's a movement that argues constantly over issues like, for example, you know, you ask two feminists about pornography today, you're going to get two very different answers. And while I'm hardly, you know, in and of myself that important, I'm really not, there are feminists on both sides of the Hugo Switzer issue and the larger issue of men and feminism. There are certainly some feminists who are deeply troubled by my presence. But, you know, I'm getting published on feminist websites respectfully, not because I think I'm the most wonderful writer in the world, but because feminist editors, women feminist editors, have decided that there is something of value that I have to say. And, you know, I always make sure the editors of the journals that I write for, Jezebel and so forth, they know my story. They're not going to be blindsided by it. I think at this point with Google, no one's going to be blindsided by me. So, you know, people have a choice to decide whether to publish me, whether to read me, whether to take it seriously. I mean, there are a lot of wonderful writers out there. And in the feminist world, the vast majority of them are women. So no one's obligated to read me. And so driving, you know, there is no closed community to drive me out of.
Moving on to something else, there's been a bit of so-called gender wars happening in Australia at the moment with the Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, standing up in Parliament and attacking the opposition leader, Tony Abbott, and saying, you know, he creates an environment of sexism and misogyny that's harmful for women. Have you been across that over there in America?
Yes. Well, I mean, it's one of the things about Twitter, where I just tweeted you, is that after about 10 o'clock at night here in Los Angeles, my Twitter is mostly Australia. And so I followed the Prime Minister's speech, and then when it went up on YouTube, I watched it, and the first time I'd ever watched a Prime Minister's speech from your wonderful country, it really was impressive. I've never seen a head of state of, well, she's not the head of state, is she? I mean, you know, it's the head of government of any country make such a powerful feminist statement as the one that I heard your PM make last week. It was really extraordinary.
Well, yeah, well, thank you for joining us. And, yeah, good luck with everything, and I'll keep on reading you.
Well, thank you so much. Bubble, I do appreciate your reading, and I appreciate your interest in chatting. All the best.
Thank you. Bye.
Sunday Night Saffron.
On Triple J.
On Triple J. You're listening to Sunday Night Saffron, Bob McGuire, John Saffron. And we've got, I like the interview.
If you want an interesting night reading, you should Google his name and see what people have to say.
Because
there's some people who say, you know, he had to have his past kind of beaten out of him a little bit, and he kind of wasn't.
Yeah, but it's redemption, the whole painful process.
Well, that's
of
the other thing I forgot to ask him about, which I'm kicking myself what? Now, is he's got some Christian angle too.
Has he?
Yes.
See, he said life's work is not to make up for what he's done wrong, but to help other men to come. Well, that's redemption and penance and reconciliation and all that kind of thing.
Americans are like that. You're allowed to.
Are they like that?
Because of Jesus. You kind of get to.
Aussies not?
Yeah, you don't get away with it. People are a bit. See, if you say I've done this stuff in the past and now I've redeemed in Australia, people are a bit sceptical.
Oh, very sceptical.
They want you to have some other kind of answer. Yeah. Whilst if you do that in America, the person's kind of forced your hand. Like, I'm redeemed now because, you know, I found Jesus.
Well, see, if he's saying about the 12 steps programs, is it 12 or 10? 12, I think, isn't it? You see, because that's part of it. It's just the redemption. And but, I mean, he raised the question of the time limit. How long ago has some crime have had to be committed before you can be forgiven and all that? Clint Eastwood was in a marvelous film called that. Was that Redemption?
I think so. Hey, can you ask me some, can you throw some moral questions
oh,
at
yes.
me?
Oh, so.
Because I'm going on that TV show on Channel 10, Can of Worms.
Oh.
And they throw moral questions on you and you have to, like, answer.
Oh.
So give me one.
And I don't know. The Runaway Train one is always famous, the Runaway Train
what's
one,
that?
Isn't it?
No, what's the Runaway Train?
You've got your Rolls Royce.
Yeah, what about it?
Is parked down at the end of the line and the train is apparently is runaway.
Yes.
And you've got to make up your mind. You can see by looking down the track, if you don't divert the train, it's going to crash into your Rolls Royce.
Yeah.
However,
yes.
As you look further down the track, there was a small child walking on the other track. And if you divert the train from destroying your Rolls-Royce, it is going to kill the child. What are you going to do?
Well, I'm not going to kill the child.
That's a moral dilemma. How do you know?
How's that a moral?
It's a moral dilemma. People will choose to protect their valuable property even at the expense of human life.
Mm. I'm pretty unethical, but even I would go for the Rolls Royce.
You say you'd go for the Rolls Royce.
I'm pretty sure I'd go for the Rolls Royce
well,
over the child.
Well, you had a moral dilemma. Come on, give us an example in your personal life.
No, you could have thrown them at me. I don't know. Just it's got to be something that's a bit more...
What? Just more what? Manageable?
No.
We mustn't have unmanageable
a bit harder.
Moral
that's not
dilemmas,
at all hard. It's not, I'm saying
you don't want to go to drones and know whether you should fly over Afghanistan and let loose because some fool told you on a text message, by the way, there's 17 terrorists living in house number 43. Mm-hmm. And you're the remote controller of the drone, and you say, oh, let's go and what did Obama say about bin Laden? Let's kill him or take him out or something.
Mm-hmm.
There's moral dilemmas all over the place, comrades.
Yeah, well, it's a much better one than the Rolls Royce and the child.
But, I mean, domestic moral dilemmas, you see.
Like what?
Well, that's the thing, you see. Dogs, cats, all that kind of thing, you see.
Dogs and cats.
Dogs and cats, moral dilemmas, you see. When, if the dog does, you know what,
Do you
on
hit
your
it?
Floor, do you try to punish it, chastise it out of anger?
Mm.
Or are you trying to remonstrate with the dog so that he learns or she learns?
I'm pretty happy you're not
you
hosting
I mean?
Can of Worms.
Well,
and it's in fact that woman from the circle.
What kind of moral dilemmas do they usually have? Come on, give us an example of a moral dilemma. In Australia.
Know.
Are there any moral
just
dilemmas?
Stuff about, I don't know, like abortion or something.
Oh, that's heavy stuff. That's heavy stuff. You're going to get into that, are you?
No, they throw the questions at me.
Oh, dear. Be careful of all those. Mm. Are you allowed to, just sidestep them? Or have you got to answer them?
No. You have to write yes or no on a card.
Ooh, dear, dear. So father is there in the hospital waiting room, and somebody says there's a woman in there going to have an abortion, and she wants to see a Catholic priest, and he goes and he says he sees an unconscious and waiting for operation is his sister. See what I mean?
What?
What can he say to her?
Oh, his own sister.
His own sister. What is he going to say?
Yeah.
There, darling, everything's going to be all right. Or come with me, my dear, and I will look after the baby if you let the baby be born.
Well, this
haven't I not given you four moral dilemmas?
But who am I now? Am I the woman or the priest or the brother?
No, you're the priest. You have to make up your mind. What are you going to do? Are you going to intervene?
Ah, yes.
You see? And say, take my sister out of here. See what I mean? Does our mother know that she's here? Well, then the other person would pop up and say, excuse me, your sister happens to be 44 years of age.
And
make up her own mind.
You can follow us on Twitter.
Well, it's late. We've run out of time, comrade.
Father Bob or John Safran.
Yeah, we'll
Twitter.
Follow you. Follow you. They get much more value out of.
And Soipel, our producer, Soipl. You can follow us on Facebook.
I mean, follow me on YouTube now.
You can go to the podcast tomorrow.
I've got pictures on YouTube.
And download that or go to SoundCloud and listen to us.
Mm.
And this is going to be one of the last episodes where Bob's going in and out of the microphone because...
I'm never going to go out. I will not roll back on the chair. See, they even put casters on the chair to tempt me to roll back. See what I mean? They knew. They knew what they were doing. What about Fenella?
And Fenella's coming up next. Thank you, Fenella.
And don't forget Tom and Alex.
In the morning.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.